Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening. Jesus, the Messiah, took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been engaged to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Her husband, Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. But just when he had resolved to do this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. "Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. When Joseph awoke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife, but had no marital relations with her until she had borne a son, and he named him Jesus.
The Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot about Joseph, but it hasn't stopped us from trying to imagine Joseph. So I want us to look together at just a couple of the images that folks have created of Joseph over time. So Wes, if you'll show us our first image here. Maybe. We may not get to look at images. There we have Joseph. This is a stone sculpture from 1250. Mostly what I'd start with is that Mary last week, over and over and over through the centuries, we have artists depicting Mary in all kinds of ways and in all kinds of expressions. Joseph, not so much attention on Joseph. So it's a little trickier to find images to show you all from Joseph because, frankly, we just don't get as much. Here's one of the more famous. This is from 1635, Saint Joseph with the infant Jesus. Mostly I draw your attention to the age of Joseph. Yeah, he looks like a grandfather, wouldn't you say? See, folks got really uncomfortable with this notion of the virgin birth. One of the ways I think that we kind of backed away from it was we said, well, Joseph must have been 90 years old. Therefore, no sexual attraction at all. Right. So that's happened over the centuries, and really actually until around the 17th century, most of the images you'll see of Joseph are of an old, old man. And a book that was written after the Bible that wasn't included in our sacred text actually writes that Joseph, when Jesus was born, they suspect he was 90 years old. See, folks were trying to make sense of how this could all be. They couldn't put all the pieces together. It didn't fit in a box, but that doesn't mean we didn't try. And so maybe Joseph was more like Mary's age back then, the regular age that you got married. I'll look at some parents when I say this. 14, 15, not today, right? At least we hope, not today for most of our folks. But back in Joseph and Mary's day, that was when the marriage was arranged. So we get a 14 or 15-year-old who looks like this 95-year-old right in front of us. And this next image is perhaps the most famous of images of Joseph. You see Mary, you see Joseph. The baby Jesus is tucked in the arms of Mary in this Rembrandt painting. And you see the angel visiting. This is actually the second time the angel comes to Joseph. This is the time when the angel comes to send Joseph and his family back to Egypt. We talked about this a few weeks ago in worship. Most often what we find, and this is a last contemporary image by a Roman Catholic painter and artist named Michael O'Brien. Mostly when we see Joseph, we see him with Mary, with the infant. I want to share just a few words from this painter. His name again is Michael O'Brien, and he left his vocation, his work, in 1976 to follow a calling in his own life. And so he left the stability of health insurance and all those things to venture out on his own into the unknown world of being a professional artist. Some of our musicians might resonate with that story. It comes with a lot of unknowns. He's made his way, and he offers these words to other artists who might be looking to do the same in the name of faith. During the most difficult periods of my life, God taught me to trust that God was and is doing something through and in me. Even when it seemed hopeless and radically insecure, which was most of the time. In fact, those are the times when God can bring about the best growth in us, if we continually renew our willingness to undergo this discipleship of trust. So in all of this, my advice for your work, for your soul, is that you ask for the grace to be perfectly docile to the Holy Spirit, and ask continually for everything you need, both spiritually and materially, then the doors will open, not by our will, but by God's. This is an artist who knew difficulty, who knew what it was like to be day to day, who found what it meant to trust and to touch grace. That's the arc of Joseph's story as well. We're going to return to that. But before we do, I want to take a moment to look at the words of Joseph, his dialect. We've tried this each week, right? It's not just that we're going to tie on the character by looking like the character, but we're also going to want to hear what the character has to say. The good news is you'll need no cliff notes for what Joseph has to say, because he has nothing to say. In the entire Bible, Joseph says nothing. Nothing. There's a lot that we've put together based on nothing that this person has actually said. We don't have a single recorded word, but his life has spoken volumes. And we're left mostly, maybe entirely, to infer about what it was like for him to be this supporting person in Mary's life. For his life is surely critical to this story. One of the things that maybe most of us know, our daughter Eleanor is 2, and so she just got a little nativity scene. And it was a couple weeks ago, so we were playing with baby Jesus and Santa constantly in our home. And the baby Jesus is next to Joseph, and you can tell that Joseph is a worker. That's the thing that we mostly think about, right? He's a carpenter. And I'm not sure what comes to your mind when you think of carpenter, but I want to take us back just for a moment to see a little bit of what it would have been like for this Joseph to be a carpenter back in his day. We know from Mark 6, verse 3, that that's what Joseph was. The literal word in Greek is a tekton, a tekton. And we're not quite sure exactly what that means. It could take on a variety of meanings. Mostly what people think is that it was some kind of a woodworker. A lot of scholars would argue that this was an itinerant woodworker. It's not someone that like had a place that you came to, but he took his tools and kind of went on the road. See, very few of the homes were built of wood, so a woodworker would have been left to kind of create the doors or the roof, or maybe to put tools back together. It was a pretty lowly job. I suspect it was a pretty lonely job as well at times. It might help us, it helped me, to think about Joseph's role as a woodworker, as a tecton, in contrast to another builder of Joseph's day. And this is a builder that is utterly contrasting to Joseph, and that's Herod. So Herod was a different kind of a builder. See, Herod was certain that he was going to build the largest monuments you could possibly fathom to make sure that his name lived on in history forever and ever and ever. He finished the temple in this grandiose way, and then right next to Bethlehem, he built a huge mountain. Actually, let's be really clear, he did not build this. He had built for him, by all the people that he had under him, a huge mountain. And on the top of that mountain, he placed a castle. It's almost like an Egyptian pyramid, except it's not the place where we bury the dead. For Herod, and for him, it was a place where he could put his castle and then look down on everyone else. At the bottom of this, there was a pool. You can imagine in a desert, if you come across a pool at the bottom of this, that's a pretty cool place to go hang out, yes? Herod wanted to make sure everyone knew who the master builder of that area was. He had a theater that could seat up to 900 people. He was ready for anything and everything, a palace that was fit for a king. So the connection to Joseph is simply this. This mountain, this castle, is adjacent to Bethlehem. So you couldn't walk anywhere in Bethlehem without looking up to this huge mountain and palace. Folks undoubtedly marveled at it as it was being built. So he's a builder on a massive scale. Joseph, he's a simple woodworker. And in contrast to Herod, who wanted so desperately to make an immortal mark on the world, Joseph didn't have those aspirations. His role as the father of Jesus is quiet, behind the scenes, you might say humble. The ruins of Herod's monument are still around, and they stand as a testimony to all that he wanted people to remember, but it's turned upside down. See, when people look at those ruins, what we think about is self-indulgence. We think about arrogance and self-centeredness. Joseph, though, we don't have a single recorded word for him, but his story reminds us that life isn't about those affirmations or that wealth or that power, but it's about humbly serving, saying yes to God. You'll notice, in contrast as well to Mary last week, no one ever prays, "Hail Joseph, full of grace." Just doesn't roll off the tongue, does it? Joseph doesn't have a book in the New Testament that's named after him. There's no title of honor that's bestowed. None of his words are preserved, and yet somehow he's a simple, humble man who does what God asks. You might say he's a consummate supporting actor. So Joseph doesn't seem to want all of that attention, and yet somehow still we come back to him as someone who is righteous. Matthew ascribes righteousness to him. And I'm not sure if you've ever thought about that or wondered about it, but what did it mean for Joseph to be righteous? Why was he righteous? What was happening there? See, I think he wanted to just go on being a carpenter, follow through with the wedding to Mary, find a quiet little place next to his parents' place in Nazareth, in Bethlehem. But all those plans, they crashed. They totally shattered. Some of us, I know, have trouble with this whole notion of the virgin birth, right? I want to tell you something, though. Joseph, he had a much harder time than you can even fathom with this notion of a virgin birth. You can imagine that Mary comes to him with this news. It's not hard to guess what his response might have been, correct? He's furious. He's broken. And I suspect as he settled into that brokenness and into that hurt, he was just utterly filled with anger. And so he had several choices. If he was a man of the law, she should be put to death. So there were two ways that if a woman became pregnant in this way, there are two things that could happen to her. If it was in a city, then she's just put to death, no questions asked. But if it's in a rural area, then there was some leeway because they thought that she could not yell out for help. But in the city, it was utterly assumed that that's her fault. So following the law, Joseph just says, she's done. We're putting her to death. He also could have, and this one doesn't get much attention, he also could have just trusted her story. But in the midst of the tears and the anger, I suspect he couldn't do that either. So he found a third way. He's going to dismiss her quietly, we're told. And so I want to pause for a moment in that image to dismiss her quietly. See, if Joseph had done this, if Joseph had dismissed her quietly, then she still would have had the child, right? And I don't know about you, but when people have weddings and babies right around each other, folks get really good at math. They get really good at counting back 9.5 months when that happens, yes? So I suspect that she has the child, the wedding is called off, and everyone would have known that Joseph had impregnated her and then left her. So Joseph would have taken on a lot of that guilt, a lot of that anger of all the people around them himself, because people would have known that it was him who did this. It's actually the case in their day that her dad could have said, oh, no, you don't, and forced them to marry anyways. And it's also the case that if that would have happened, he would have paid the rest of the dowry and gone on his way. He could have been his own lead actor. And like, I'm done with this. I'm writing my own story. That could have happened. And I suspect Joseph thought about it. I suspect he considered all of those things and wasn't sure where to go or what to do. So when Joseph tries to dismiss her quietly, I want to be really clear that he's not following the letter of the law. He's following a totally other path to take on some of that himself. I think that might be why the author of Matthew calls him righteous. And maybe people who seek to follow Jesus in our day could learn something from that understanding of righteousness. Perhaps the righteous plan helped pave the way then for a dream. A dream that turned Joseph's world upside down, that called him not to dismiss her quietly, but to say yes to God and to the hope that Mary might give birth to God's love in the world, and that he'd be a supporting actor in that role. So humble, righteous, loving, supportive. But there's an underneath part that we often think about with Joseph. And I really started to hit me this week. I started to wonder, is he just totally impotent? Like, is this just a powerless guy? Have you ever wondered this? Like, when you come for the Christmas Eve story and the kids are all dressed up, we know that Joseph doesn't have a single line, but when the person says there's no room in the inn, does Joseph just go, ah, shucks, and follow Mary back to the barn? Like, really? Does this person have no more authority than to just say, yeah, we'll take the barn. Next to the cow, fine. That is a horrible image in my mind of supporting Mary and the baby. And it really started to hit me this week, like, what is wrong with this guy? Can't we give him a couple lines? Like, no, we're not going to go have a baby in the barn. That's not okay. Right? So I want to take us back. There's an author that helped me think about this differently, and it's really different. It's going to make the Christmas Eve story. When we tell the Christmas Eve story, the congregation is used to saying, no room in the inn, and everybody does this shh thing. It happens all the time, because basically we take a bunch of different pieces of the Christmas story, we pull them together until they're utter chaotic nonsense, and then we try to make it all align for people. But these aren't lines. They're stories, and they're stories that are told about how God came into the world, and they don't always makes sense to us. And the Christmas story is like that. So to understand what really maybe happened, what Joseph really did to support Mary back in that day, I want to invite us to think about the world in Joseph's day, what a house actually looked like. Okay? So first, when I think of a barn, I think of a place. I don't think of barns, I'll be honest. I don't ever think about barns, but I visited Antonio at the farm a couple weeks ago, and that reminded me of a barn. And it's a pretty lowly, desolate place, even in this day. In Joseph's day, here's what a house looked like, especially a peasant house. There'd be a main room. And then there would be a room where the parents were, and then there would be one other room, and it would be, in the Greek, it's called a kataluma. And the room then is where all the kids stayed, okay? It's also, that kataluma is also the same place that Jesus gathers his disciples for that last meal, okay? So there's a room on the side of a house that's for the kids. But when family come, or when guests arrive, the kids move into bed with the parents, and then that becomes the extra room, right? So you have an image of this. Oftentimes what happened was the animals were on the first floor of a house, and then the people were on the second floor of the house. It depended on the wealth and exactly where people were in that space. But no matter what, that's about all we've got, okay? And in that space, if your animals are your most prized possession, guess what? You're going to bring them inside, especially when it's cold at night. And so inside, if you know you're going to bring your animals inside, you know that you're going to have a trough right there. And it's going to be one of the sturdier places, because animals aren't that gentle. No matter how much we romanticize the story on Christmas Eve, they're just not. So you've got to make this space for the animals to eat and to drink their water that's sturdy, that's strong. You have an image of that space that that Joseph is walking into. So Joseph is taking his family back to his hometown. And when he does this, his wife is on the verge of giving birth. You can imagine that the rest of the family is already there. They go a little quicker than Joseph does. And guess what? That room is filled. That one guest room, it's taken. So when we read there's no room in the inn, there literally was no room in their home for another person to go there. And then when we imagine Mary giving birth, you can imagine a culture in which at birth, the woman is unclean. So it's not likely that this was a birth like many of you have had in this day, where the partner is there with you in that space. But Joseph and the other men, they were not in the room because it wasn't religiously acceptable for them to be in that space. And so when Mary gives birth in a manger area, she's giving birth inside the home in a place where the animals were, because I guess it probably felt like that would be the place to do this, all things considered, in their house. And it kept the rest of the home so that when the child was born, Mary and the child could move back into the house with the rest of the family to celebrate, to live, to start off on a new journey. So it's not some wimpy Joseph going along going, no room in the inn, okay, well, we'll just go to the barn. It's Joseph taking Mary with him. If she went on her own, she would have had no one in that town, nowhere to give birth to that child. So he used his own family connections, his own privilege, to create a way for her. That's what support looks like in the world. And for many of us, the privileges that we have, whether we're aware of them or not, when we're called to support someone else, that's mostly how we're called to do it. is to be deeply in touch with who we are and whose we are to help pave a way for folks that don't have those privileges, those connections. And that's a different image of a Joseph. That's another way of being a supporting actor, a supporting person in this story. Last week, Linda shared with us Mary's lead role in this story. How Mary responded to God with a simple phrase, "Here I am." And in doing so, she took the lead role in giving birth to a holy human being, the bearer of salvation, not in a palace on the edge of Bethlehem, but in that house where there was no room, but they made a way. See, in the continuing drama of the Gospels, not everyone is fit to be cast as Mary. Our culture says that we should all be Mary. We're all Mary. Let's all lead. We'll all lead the way. And yet Joseph might remind us that every single day God is breaking into the world in the lives of the people around us. And sometimes it's the life of the person who's called to support that we're called to live into. And I want to be clear, it's not an easier life. Joseph didn't find it any easier than Mary did. You might even say it was more challenging for him, or maybe you just say, I'm a guy reading the story. It's more challenging for him, but maybe it really was. See, he had to give up his own image of who he was and what everyone else thought about him, to say yes to a person he longed to support as she gave birth to God's hope in the world. See, being Joseph means that your life is dramatically changed by the work of God in the life of someone else. Who are those folks in your life that you're called to support? See, being Joseph means that we'll be tempted to come up with some plans, like the plan he came up with to dismiss her quietly. We'll be tempted to go in a different direction and just leave her behind. It's less messy that way. Being Joseph means that we might have to resist this unwanted interruption. See, that's the tendency. We want to resist that interruption, but Joseph shows us a different way. Maybe we'll try to manage it. That's a lot easier. If we could just manage God, manage the birth. Maybe you'll distance yourself and just run totally away from it. But that wouldn't be following the script, would it? See, Joseph was humble and righteous, compassionate and forgiving, willing to creatively use his relationships, his own privileges, to make a way for the one who was responding so deeply to God's love. A simple woodworker who understood at the end of the day how everything fit together. It came to him in a dream, and he left those plans behind to take the stage in supporting Mary into the unknown of God's future. Some of us might be called to support in those ways this day and every day.